I never really appreciated the way that stealth games taught me the importance of being brave and seizing opportunities in risky situations. I guess you could call them a sort of virtual reality. Imagine that, through a series of unlikely events at CERN, a book of sheet music fell into a wormhole and was teleported across the galaxy, appearing on the desk of some alien creature. The peculiar assortment of shapes and symbols becomes a subject of intensive investigation in the alien culture. Conflicting schools of theory and interpretation are developed around it. Arguments about what rules govern the patterns and sequences of notes, the significance of crescendos, and how sharps and flats should be deployed in this or that key signature. Centuries later, they discover Earth, and anxiously ask some human ambassador which of their theories about Earthling music is right. She says, "Well, what does your music sound like?" The aliens slowly turn to each other, confused. Sound? According to philosopher Alistair MacIntyre, this is more or less the situation we find ourselves in with respect to ethics in the 21st century. We are the hapless aliens, missing something essential at the heart of our discussions of right and wrong. And without it, all our philosophical comparison and analysis is hopelessly untethered from anything that might give it any substance. In his book, After Virtue, he attempts to explain both how we got to this sorry state and how we might recover some meaningful path forward. Now, if you're a regular viewer of this channel, you might raise an eyebrow at his claim that ethics is in some sort of crisis. Utilitarianism, pragmatism, we've covered all sorts of nuanced and interesting theories about what separates good from evil. But for MacIntyre, the attempts to establish a rational basis for morality aren't just unconvincing and mutually inconsistent. They were doomed to fail from the outset. To see why, let's take a classic moral dilemma. A runaway trolley is hurtling toward five people tied to the tracks, and you're standing on a bridge over the tracks with a fat man, whose large body would almost assuredly stop it. Do you push him off the bridge in front of the trolley? One person might say, "The fat man has a right to life and autonomy. Murdering him is a clear violation of those rights and morally reprehensible." Another person might say, "The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, and the ends justify the means. It would be morally reprehensible to allow four additional people to die in this situation if you have a chance to save them." How are we to choose between these competing conceptions of morality? Well, we can't. I mean, one of those arguments might seem more compelling to you, but if someone prefers the other one, now what? What can we point to resolve that dispute? As David Hume noted, we can collect empirical data all day long, amassing a mountain of facts about people's ages and life expectancy and whatnot, but as soon as someone says that data means we ought to do something or other, anyone could reasonably dispute that claim by simply saying, "I feel differently." That volatility leads some to embrace a philosophy called emotivism, which suggests that moral statements, like torturing kittens is wrong, aren't really statements of moral facts. They're just expressions of a person's approval or disapproval. Something like, "Boo, kitten torture." For emotivists, all this faff about good and evil and right and wrong boils down to people saying what they like or dislike about certain situations or actions, pretty much the same way they might say they prefer this or that flavor of ice cream. However, despite the emotivist posture of shedding childish fairy tales of morality, MacIntyre points out that it's not less silly than all those moral theories it claims to supersede. If I say something like, "Torturing kittens is wrong," it's pretty clear that I mean something very different than, "I really, really, really don't like kitten torture." One statement clearly expresses my personal preferences, but the other seems to be gesturing at a sort of universal standard which I expect everyone to observe and abide by. Even if we were to say that I was just expressing disapproval of kitten torture, what kind of disapproval am I expressing exactly? Aesthetic? Practical? Political? We'd probably conclude that I was expressing a form of moral disapproval, and an emotivist would need to explain where that comes from, without some appeal to morality. So, on the one hand, there's no clear objective basis we might use to resolve ethical disputes, and according to Hume, there never could be, even in principle. On the other hand, emotivism is clearly missing something important about the way that we talk and think about morality. It's possible that every single person who says torturing kittens is wrong is simply mistaken about what they're saying, that they're really just expressing big feelings instead of moral facts. But that's a pretty monstrous bullet to bite, and it comes with all sorts of new problems. For MacIntyre, This entire situation is the unfortunate result of a sort of tragic philosophical blunder a few hundred years ago. During the Enlightenment, the institution of the Catholic Church was decoupled from its commanding position in just about every system that affected European life, including its role as the arbiter of moral truth. So much the better, as Luther correctly noted that selling indulgences to the wealthy while the poor went hungry was transparently evil. That decoupling took the form of a multifaceted skeptical attack on the medieval blend of Aristotelian and Christian theology that defined morality in terms of a supernatural cosmic order. According to that tradition, humans exist in a corrupted mortal state, but by learning and following the sacred laws set out by God Almighty, they can align themselves with the divine, transcend their sinful nature, and ultimately receive their just reward in heaven. That story certainly explains the difference between good and evil, and a solid reason to choose good, if you happen to believe it. But Enlightenment philosophers poked holes in it for centuries on end, and many arrived at the conclusion that acting morally based on the promise of eternal salvation was superstitious nonsense. That left philosophers with the project of figuring out what did justify morality, using the newfangled individualist rationality that was in vogue at the time. Hume posited a sort of innate sympathy with other creatures that compels us to do good. Kant suggested that logical self-consistency required rational people to behave according to certain principles, like never tell a lie. Mill wrote that, because each person desires their own happiness, it's indisputable that we should generalize that principle and pursue the greatest good for all. None of these ideas really gave us a solid footing for ethics, and according to McIntyre, they couldn't, because, in the rush to kick hypocritical Catholic moral dogma to the curb, the Enlightenment accidentally tossed out something essential for morality to continue working, what Aristotle called a telos, a purpose, a function, an ultimate goal. Telos gives evaluative statements some teeth. If my watch sucks at telling me what time it is a bad watch, because it does not satisfy the telos of a watch, telling time. Its badness is not simply a matter of opinion or taste. It's not just a bad watch for me. There are certain criteria intrinsic to its being a watch that it can either satisfy or fail to satisfy. And in virtue of those criteria, it can be factually described as a good or mediocre or bad watch. In the Catholic version of morality, the telos of humankind is salvation. We're tempted to do evil, but if we follow these rules, we can achieve our ultimate purpose and receive an eternal reward in heaven. In the Enlightenment philosopher's version, we're tempted to do evil, but if we follow these rules, meh. For McIntyre, this telos is the sound that the aliens were missing in our little sci-fi story, and it's why the course of ethics since the Enlightenment has led to this weird situation where everyone uses moral language that seems to be pointing at some objective truth, but also treats moral assertions as though they were just expressions of strong feelings. We could talk about categorical imperatives and human rights and utility all day long, but without some notion of an ultimate purpose that humans are trying to achieve with those ideas, all that moral language is just flopping around, untethered from anything concrete that might make it true or false. To recover a functional version of ethics, he suggests that we have to look at a time before the Enlightenment attempts at rational ethics, before Thomas Aquinas bundled Aristotelian thought with Catholicism and its whole sin-God-afterlife thing, all the way back to the philosopher himself, Aristotle. Aristotle's ethical treatises are distinct from the Enlightenment approaches that you're probably familiar with. He doesn't really try to codify moral behavior in a set of rules or principles, but focuses his attention on a collection of virtues, learned behaviors that he thinks are necessary to live a good life as a Greek citizen. Friendliness, generosity, good temper, honesty, practical know-how. Note that I say virtues, plural. We tend to think of virtue as more of a singular quality of character, a person's tendency to do the right thing, come what may. But Aristotle believes that while the virtues are entangled to some extent, and all are necessary to live the good life, they're ultimately independent. A person might be a paragon of generosity, but tragically dishonest. In his estimation, the end goal, the telos of human life, is to die satisfied that one has lived well, which we can only achieve by learning and practicing each and every virtue. Again, the imperatives to be even-tempered and generous aren't just abstract commandments that are handed down from on high or deduced from first principles. They're simply a set of recommendations if you want to live well. Aristotle doesn't claim you're violating some cosmic order of right and wrong if you're stingy or quick to anger. You're just getting in your own way. Of course, McIntyre doesn't think that behaviors Aristotle picked out as being well-suited for living a fulfilling life as an ancient Athenian aristocrat will be equally applicable to every other human in every cultural or historical context. But he thinks the way Aristotle set out identifying those qualities is what we should be paying attention to. The process of determining what virtues are important for achieving our telos of living well, built on three major components: a practice, a narrative, and a moral tradition. A practice is a school or discipline with a body of knowledge and shared standards of excellence. Painting, engineering, rock climbing, carpentry, medicine, there are known criteria for success or failure in these enterprises, and a community of dedicated practitioners who have some defensible claim to expertise. Engaging in a practice, like learning how to cook, comes with a whole bundle of potential upsides. You can impress people with your cooking skills. You can save money by avoiding restaurants. You can eat healthier and tastier meals. But you could also get those benefits in other ways, like deception or pulling a dine-in dash. However, there are internal goods which can only be acquired by engaging with and overcoming the challenges unique to the practice of cooking. The feeling of mastery over your craft, the triumph of finally nailing a recipe that has given you trouble for months, the satisfaction that you've done good work, the confidence that you can coax a decent meal out of just about any fridge, all sorts of amazing stuff that you simply can't have unless you put in the effort and acquire the necessary skills. Those skills are the virtues. If you actually want to be a good cook, you must acquire preparation, attention, flexibility, discipline, practical wisdom, that sort of stuff. Although making yourself tasty meals is great, to get really good at cooking, there are a number of other essential skills necessary to participate in the community of experts and fellow practitioners, to effectively absorb the body of cultural knowledge kept by other cooks. You need the humility to know what you're not great at, so you can study with people who know it well. You have to be honest about your successes and failures. You have to show courage to ask people who really know their stuff to be brutally honest about your food. Notably, all these virtues are useful for you to make a dynamite penne alla vodka, but they also have to advance the practice of cooking. A community of courageous, humble, honest cooks, debating and testing and honing their skills together, is great for anyone else who wants to participate in that practice. And each additional member is one more person you can ask for advice or aid. Sure, there will always be free riders who steal recipes without so much as a please or thank you, but they're really shooting themselves in the foot by failing to cultivate the virtues they need to excel, denying themselves all those internal goods. Again, none of this is some holy mandate. You can certainly try to cook a meal without acquiring the requisite virtues, you're just unlikely to be satisfied with the results. And you won't be able to call on them in other areas of your life where they might have been useful. So we've got a rough idea of what virtues are and their intimate relationship with the internal goods of practices, but it's pretty vague. If I'm holding off on some important decision, am I being patient or timid? This is where the second part of McIntyre's formula comes in, a narrative. Often, when Enlightenment thinkers discuss ethics, they focus on singular actions or their consequences. But there are a million different ways to frame just about any action. If I push the fat man in front of the trolley, am I saving five lives? Am I callously ignoring the rights of an individual? Am I proving to myself that I'm a real utilitarian? Maybe I'm indulging in some murderous fantasy in a situation where I think I can get away with it. Establishing my intentions is critical when we're trying to weigh the moral import of my actions, as is how we characterize the situation. And that's really a narrative exercise. Fitting my behavior to a coherent story about me, my character, my history, my desires, and the setting in which I'm acting. It doesn't make a lot of sense to say I'm a paragon of patience if I keep waiting for the right moment to ask out my crush until they start dating someone else. My virtue, or lack thereof, has to be contextualized in an intelligible narrative framework. Essentially, I am a character in the story of my life, and whether I am a heroic, or tragic, or villainous character can't be fully determined by examining a single action on its own. Of course, I'm not the sole author of that story. Different people will experience my decisions differently, which will complicate that account. In my story, I heroically stayed up late to finish the script, but in my wife's version, I procrastinated for weeks and then kept her up typing away in the living room. Questions like, who am I and what am I doing, and am I exhibiting this or that virtue, are answered in the unity of all these different interlocking narratives, through a collective project of storytelling and interpretation, which leads to the final part of McIntyre's account, a moral tradition, a community with a set of shared narratives, values, and roles, the result of a historical dialogue about what it means to live well as a member of the community. Catholicism is a moral tradition, as is Confucianism, liberal individualism, or the ancient Greek city-state. Each describes a set of well-defined social roles, like mother, godfather, citizen, scholar, noble, or worker, which carry certain obligations, stories about what it looks like to live virtuously in those roles, even in moments of crisis, and a shared vision of what it looks like for the whole society to be flourishing together. Notably, those traditions agree with each other more than they disagree. They mostly differ in the specifics of how virtues should be instantiated or prioritized by people in certain roles for the success of the community. A Catholic nun and a Greek citizen soldier are both expected to exhibit patience and courage, but in different ways. A moral tradition can be accepted, questioned, modified, even rejected by its members, but it forms a unifying conceptual vocabulary for the stories we tell, and supplies a collective notion of a telos by which our success can be measured. The degree to which a society built on some moral tradition actually achieves its chosen telos gives us some idea about the health of that tradition. If the society is in constant upheaval, or its members aren't living good lives, the tradition probably needs to be updated or abandoned. With all that, we now have a framework to understand statements like, "you should be just," as something more than expressions of personal preference. If you want to live a superb life, you want it to be full of internal goods, like feelings of confidence and mastery, which you can only get by being excellent at something, requiring the cultivation of certain faculties. Justice might not be in your nature, but you'd be well served learning to be even-handed, like when you're evaluating how your performance stacks up against others in your chosen practice. If you can develop that capacity, it will make you better at your practice and improve the health of the community you rely on to hone that proficiency. Thankfully, your culture has a set of stories about what it looks like for someone like you to live a good life full of justice in a flourishing society, and you can reference those stories to navigate dilemmas or problems of fairness, aiming toward that vision of the good life. So, to live well, you should be just. Now, as adherents of the moral tradition of the liberal Enlightenment, we generally approach ethics looking for something profound, an eternal, universal prescription for all human behavior built on principles that hold, regardless of the observer's history or social status or culture or theology or whatever. But in McIntyre's estimation, the inevitable conclusion of that tradition is a miserable, selfish, nihilistic battle of wills with anyone who feels differently. An endless shouting match of my supposed right to this versus your supposed right to that, putting a noble face on a war of each against all. His Aristotelian account of a lowercase g good, of simply wanting to live the best life available to a certain kind of person in a particular social and historical context, is a humbler sort of thing. But it grounds those debates of what we should or shouldn't do in a teleological framework, one that doesn't treat morality as though it's some math equation or holy mandate, but as a contingent fact of what it takes for you, specifically, to live well in a thriving community. That telos enables us to bring all sorts of interesting analytical tools to bear on questions of morality. When I ask, should I push the fat man onto the trolley tracks? Rather than laser focusing on the morality of the act itself, or zooming out to the sum total of morality in the history of the universe, we might ask questions like, well, what kind of role do you occupy in your society? Is pushing him compatible with a good life for someone like you? Does being the sort of person who would push him benefit or harm your society? In the story of your life, would pushing him be fair, vicious, merciful? How would other people in your society tell that story? Those answers won't be the same for everybody, and maybe they shouldn't be. They do contextualize the problem in a way that maintains focus on living well together and being the best versions of ourselves, while being sensitive to empirical questions about whether successfully occupying this or that role really does result in a satisfying life and a vibrant community. For McIntyre, that's the sort of music we're trying to make together. Do you agree with McIntyre's diagnosis of the state of moral discourse and his suggestion that an ethics grounded in a vision of what a good life looks like and prescribing virtues to get there will fix it? What practice has taught you the most valuable lessons about how to live well? please leave a comment below and let me know what you think. Thank you very much for watching. Don't forget to blah, blah, subscribe, blah, share. Be excellent to each other. And don't stop thinking.